It's so really good to see everyone this morning. We are happy to have you here. We have a number of visitors with us. We're grateful that you're here, whether you're traveling through or whether you just happen to be visiting us from the community. We're grateful to have you with us this morning. I have had a couple of requests in the last several weeks for lessons. And so I'm going to try to accommodate those requests the next couple of times that I'm scheduled to present the main lesson in our services. And this is the first of those. We've been studying, of course, our Wednesday night class just finished about 2 years in studying the fourfold gospels using a book by Brother McGarvey. I was approached and asked about I was asked if I ever wondered about John being at the cross, which is something we just studied very recently, and would I present a lesson about that. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning, John's path to the cross. We know that he ended up there, but basically the idea is how did he get there? What ended up causing him to be at the cross? The passage that we have in mind is John 19, verses 25 through 27. But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. And when Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. And so there we find this disciple who is called simply the disciple whom Jesus loved. And we will identify him as John as we progress through this lesson. And we find him there at the cross. And how did it come to be that of all the disciples of Jesus, John is the one that is at the cross? The story, I think, starts in one sense the night before the crucifixion of Jesus. And we realize that the preceding night was a time of tumult, and it was a time really of great highs and lows. And these are not really the central part of our message this morning, but it's hard to understand our message this morning without recognizing this. It was a period of highs. That is three things that I would point out. It was the Passover feast. It was the weekend of the Passover. And that was one of the two most important days on the Jewish religious calendar. And it was a time when family and friends got together to observe that feast and reflect upon the meaning of that feast. And so Jesus, we are told in the Gospels, met with his disciples. And we're not sure whether it's just the 12. We realize that the famous picture of the Last Supper has what we would call the 12 apostles at it. But the scripture just says his disciples. And we know there were many more than the 12. How many were there, we do not know. We also know that it was at this time that Jesus chose to use two of the things that were a part of the Passover feast, the wine and the unleavened bread of the Passover, and he gave them new meaning, and he instituted the Lord's Supper. And one thing we don't often think about, as Jesus, even that night, told them he was going to be betrayed, it would certainly have been a high, at least from my perspective, to find the unified commitment of the disciples. Matthew 26 and verse 35 said all of them that were left, Judas has already left at this point, all said they would be willing to die with Jesus rather than deny him. That would certainly be a high point with those disciples. But we're probably much more familiar with the lows, because the lows display some of the basic failures of human nature, and we so often share in those. First of all, remember the night begins with the disciples squabbling amongst themselves as to which of them would be the greatest of his disciples. And so even though they were united in their dedication to him, they were not always united. They fell into the human errors of pride and desire and argued amongst themselves as to who should have those positions. We're told that in Luke chapter 22, verses 24 through 27. And then quite obviously there is the treachery of Judas. As Jesus says, one of you sitting here will betray me. And Judas has already made that deal with the priest, that at a convenient time he would turn Jesus over to him. Then there is the period in the garden where the disciples failed him. You remember he asked them to watch with him while he prayed and they all fell asleep. And not once, but twice. Then when the arrest came, when Judas in his betrayal brought the temple police to arrest Jesus, Matthew 27 and verse 56 says, then all of the disciples left him and fled. And so we can say, it doesn't matter whether we're only talking about the other 11 or whether there were others there. And by the way, we know that there were others there because Mark records the fact that there was a young man, and it was probably Mark that was there, and they grabbed him and he just left his clothes behind and ran away. So it's undoubtedly more than just the 11. But they all flee him. And then finally, there is the story of Peter's denial of Jesus as the trials take place. So after the events of the garden, Jesus is taken into custody, underwent a series of trials, and that eventually led him to Calvary. But of course, the question that we're looking at is not what led him to Calvary, but John was at Calvary, even though Matthew 27 says that all of the disciples fled from the garden. Now, the narrative of the Gospels does not follow most of those other disciples during the hours after Jesus' arrest and during his trials. However, the Gospels do tell us about three of those disciples. The first is Judas, and we're told of his remorse and how he tried to give the money back, and when he was rejected by the priest, he went out, Matthew 27 tells us, and hanged himself. And we are probably most familiar with Peter because of the accounts in the Gospels that after on the night at the supper, him saying he would never deny Jesus, Jesus told him he would deny him three times before the next morning, before the rooster crowed in the next morning. And we are all familiar with that story in Matthew 26, verses 69 through 75, and the other Gospels. Then there is the act of the third disciple, the one called the other disciple. And it's almost universally agreed that that other disciple is John. And the reason for that is what is mostly told us about this other disciple is in the Gospel of John. And John chooses not to talk about himself in the first person in that Gospel. And so he's probably the other disciple. And so we find about him very quickly after the arrest of Jesus. While he originally fled, he and Peter quickly regain at least some sense and follow Jesus as Jesus goes to trial. In John chapter 18 and verse 15, John says, Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside, so the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. So we find that John is probably the one who gets Peter his access into the courtyard at the high priest's house. And of course, the passage we've already read. John is at the cross with Jesus' mother and the other woman disciples. One of the things that's interesting about that is that at the cross, Jesus commits the care of his mother into this other disciple, into John. What this really indicates is that while we know later, after his resurrection, his brothers James and Jude, become leaders in the church and have actually written part of the New Testament. And James was a specific leader of the church in Jerusalem. But what this probably indicates is that they did not really come to believe in him until after the resurrection. You remember their attitude about him when he said he wasn't going to go to the feast. They said, well, if you want people to follow you, you need to go do these signs. And many people look at that and say they were not among his disciples that went with him to Jerusalem, went with him to Lazarus' house. And that would give reason to why Jesus at the cross, seeing his mother there and John being the only one there that he would recognize, he asked John to take care of his mother, and John agrees to do that. And so, even though the disciples fled, Peter and John quickly recover. But we don't hear about Peter again after he goes out and weeps bitterly until after the death of Jesus. It's all speculation about what did the other disciples do, and I'm not going to suggest to you that people don't present those ideas, but there's no biblical proof. But what we do know is John is clearly at the cross with some of the faithful women who have not abandoned Jesus when Jesus is upon the cross dying for our sins. But that still doesn't answer the question about what was there about John's relationship with Jesus that would have prompted him to be at the cross when perhaps none of the other disciples were there except those faithful women. Now, we don't know that for sure. And I have to tell you that I'm going to build the case from the Gospels that I think tells us why John would have been there. But that's really just understanding the evidence that has been presented that gives us a good idea, but it may not be all that there is to it. It's just all that we know. Among those things is that John was one of the first of the disciples called by Jesus. Shortly after, Jesus called Peter and Andrew from their fishing boats at the Sea of Galilee. He called another set of brothers who were fishermen at the same place. In Mark chapter 1 and verse 19, it says, going on a little farther, that is after he called Peter and Andrew, he saw James the son of Zebedee and John his brother, who were also in the boat mending the nets, and immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with hired servants and went away to follow him. So, among the first of the disciples that Jesus called to his earthly ministry was James and John, his brother. Now, it is also possible that John was not just another fisherman on the Sea of Galilee, but that James and John were also cousins of Jesus. Many scholars suggest this possibility. And the possibility is based simply on a comparison of two different gospel accounts. The accounts of the women at the cross. In Matthew 27 and verse 56, Matthew says that among them were Mary Magdalene, and we all know who she was, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. So that's James and John. So the mother of James and John, who played a role in the Gospels, we'll talk about that in just a moment, was at the cross with Mary, the mother of Christ, and Mary Magdalene, and this other Mary. Now, in John 19 and verse 25, when John talks about that, he says, standing at the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister. And Mary, the wife of Clopas, she is the one that's the mother of James and Joseph, and Mary Magdalene. So the only Mary, or the only one that's not accounted for, that's mentioned in two different ways, is the one that is the mother of the sons of Zebedee, and that would be Mary's sister, Mary the mother of Christ's sister. And again, would you say, well, that's absolutely unrevocable evidence? No. But it is thought that that's a possibility. And we're talking about why would John have been there when some of the other apostles would not have been? Well, one of the possible explanations is that his mother and his aunt were there and he was there with them. A little bit different approach is that during the earthly ministry, John was among the closest of Jesus' disciples. So whether James and John were actually related to Jesus or not, there can be no doubt about the fact that they were among the closest of his disciples. There are a number of times in the Gospels when Peter and Andrew, James and John, or in some cases, it was just Peter, James, and John, were separated out from the other apostles, and Jesus took them with him when he didn't take all of his apostles with them. We're even told that Jesus had a nickname for James and John. In Mark 3 and verse 17, it says, "And James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to them he gave the name Boanerges," which means sons of thunder. Now, if you understand that, that means they had some dominant personality. And there's evidence of that in the gospel accounts of the strength of their personalities. And the accuracy of that is really demonstrated in other gospel references to them. For instance, in Luke 9 and verse 49, we have this verse. John answered and said, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he does not follow along with us. We don't recognize them as being one of us, so we took it upon ourselves to stop him." That's a pretty strong personality. Then there's an even stronger one in Luke chapter 9 and verse 54. When the disciples, James and John, saw this, and this is people basically who were rejecting Jesus, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" These people aren't listening to you, Lord. Do you want us to get them destroyed? That's a pretty strong personality. And so we understand that Jesus had an affection for their zeal, even when that zeal was sometimes misdirected. So whether it was a result of a family relationship with Jesus or just an expression of their more aggressive personalities, we also know that James and John had the desire to be leaders of the disciples. After all, that's the thing they were squabbling about at the Passover dinner. We know that their mother, who happened to be at the cross, had those aspirations for them. Matthew 20 and verse 20, "Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" And she said to him, "Command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit one on your right and one on your left." Now that also is not concrete evidence that they were related. There's probably pushy mothers who aren't related to people that make those kind of requests. But it's also the kind of request somebody that was thought they had a position of relationship might make. And we know that James and John didn't say, "Oh, Mom, don't say that." Because Mark 10, verse 37 says that James and John themselves ask him and say, "Grant that we may sit one on your right and one on your left in your glory." And Jesus said to them, "You don't know what you're asking." But they did ask. And that certainly did contribute to some of the contention that we've already talked about between the disciples. The gospel really gives us no more clarification than that. But we do know from the Gospels that Jesus often separated Peter, James, and John from the rest of the disciples in some important occasions. First of all, in Luke chapter 8, we're told that a synagogue official asked Jesus to come and raise his daughter or heal his daughter who was sick. And by the time Jesus got there, she had died. But Luke 8:51 says, "When he came to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the girl's father and mother." So there were occasions when he took them with him when he was going to perform an important miracle. Of course, in Mark chapter 9 and verse 2, we're told that Peter, James, and John are the only of the disciples that Jesus took with them upon the Mount of Transfiguration. So they were witnesses to Jesus when he was transfigured before them. And by the way, both John and Peter make reference to that in their epistles. Along with Peter, John was the one that was charged with preparing that last Passover feast. In Luke 22 and verse 8, Jesus sent Peter and John saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us so that we may eat it." So he gave them the job of getting everything ready for him and all of the disciples to eat the Passover, and that is when he instituted the Lord's Supper. And even close to the time of his betrayal and his ultimate trial and then being put upon the cross, in Mark 14 and verse 33, when he left place of the Passover feast, the institution of the Lord's Supper, and went to the garden, all the disciples went with him. But Mark 14 and verse 33 says, "And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be very distressed and troubled." He left the rest of the disciples at one place in the garden, and he took those three a little farther into the garden there to pray. And then there is a statement that John makes himself in John 13 when he talks about that Last Supper, the Passover feast. He says, "There was a reclining on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved." Now, we shouldn't make more out of this than is said. People often refer to John as the disciple whom Jesus loved. But I do want you to notice that John actually says that he was one of his disciples and Jesus loved him. John simply records the fact that Jesus loved him. Of course, Jesus commanded them to love one another. And Jesus testified, as is recorded in John, in chapters 14, 15, and 16, that he loved them, all of the disciples. But the idea is that perhaps there was this special relationship that he shared with John. And so we come to say, well, this possibly is why John is at the cross when none of the others are there? Again, we cannot be sure. But we can close with something that we know for sure. We know that John was probably the last disciple to see Jesus alive, because he's at the cross. And shortly after Jesus addresses him on the cross, Jesus dies. John 20 and verse 2 points out the second thing. He was among the first to be a witness of the resurrection. So she, that's Mary Magdalene, ran to come to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." We follow down in the reading. John 20 and verse 8 says, "So the other disciple who had first come to the tomb then also entered, and he saw and believed." You know the full details of the story. John gets there first. Most people think John was the younger of the two between Peter and John. But John does not, for all of his assertiveness, he doesn't have Peter's spontaneous personality. So John stops at the door of the tomb and looks in, and Peter gets there and goes right by him into the empty tomb. And then John goes in. But it says he saw and he believed. And so these things, this is kind of a summary of the life of John that brings him to this point on the cross. We know that that group of Jesus' closest disciples plays an important role in the history of the early church. We know that Peter was the one whose first sermon is recorded in Acts 2 on the day of Pentecost for the establishment of the church. And there's a certain irony about the two brothers of James and John, because we're told in Acts 12 that James was the first of the 12 apostles to be martyred. And so when they'd asked to partake of the cup of Jesus, he said, "You don't know what you're asking. You'll do it, but you don't know what you're asking." And so James was the first to follow him in death for his cause. He's not the first disciple, because Stephen was killed before him, but he's the first of the apostles. And John was the last of the 12 to die, dying in his old age after spending time imprisoned by the Roman authorities on the Isle of Patmos. Peter's ministry is the focal point of the first half of the book of Acts. And John is the member of the 12 apostles who served both the early church in Jerusalem and the churches that spread out to the Gentiles, because at the time of his imprisonment, he was at the church at Ephesus, and it was from there that he was sent into exile on Patmos. There's a lot of different things we can learn about that. One thing I would point out is John serves as a great example of the fact that you don't have to be martyred in Christ's service. There's nothing wrong with that. And certainly, if the secular records are right, 11 of the first 12 apostles, of the first 12, all died violently, being persecuted for their faith in the Christ. But John lived and died of old age. So the point is we should be willing to die for Jesus. But John sets a perfect example of someone who lives for Jesus. And he was there at the cross, and he's our example for us. So I hope that maybe answered some of the questions that was in the mind. I don't mind ever for you to ask for me to prepare and present something. It's a little different than a normal sermon, but I think it has its purpose, and I hope that you've been benefited and edified by it. If you get your songbooks out, as we close, we're going to extend the Lord's invitation. There may be one in the audience this morning who has been thinking and meditating upon their need to obey the gospel and wants to come and confess your faith in Jesus Christ and be baptized in his name and leave this place this morning as his disciple. If that's the case, we would be rejoicing with you, and we would encourage you to take that step now as we stand and as we sing.